This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Morning, everyone. It's Joe Bonner with Andy Lewis, and we're reading the May 1st edition of the Cincinnati Enquirer, and we'll start with the business page. Grace Tucker, Enquirer staffer, writes this article. Time's up for TikTok. A bill that could lead to the nationwide ban of TikTok was signed into law last week by President Biden, USA Today reported. The legislation, which has received overwhelming bipartisan support in Congress, per USA Today, gives TikTok's Chinese parent company, ByteDance, up to a year to sell its U.S. operations or face a ban. If banned, the app would disappear from Apple and Google's app stores and for U.S. phone users. TikTok's fate has been prolonged, given the time ByteDance has been given to divest TikTok, 9 months, with a possible three-month extension. It's far longer than the six-month deadline the original House measure proposed. We think a year is an ample time to allow potential investors to come forward for due diligence to be completed and for lawyers to draw up and finalize contracts. Senator Maria Cantwell, Democrat from Washington, chair of the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, said Tuesday on the Senate floor, according to USA Today. However, the legislation will likely face legal challenges from TikTok and its supporters and government resistance from Beijing, meaning a ban could take far longer than a year to go into effect, as USA Today reports. This unconstitutional law is a TikTok ban, and we will challenge it in court, TikTok said in a statement. We believe the facts and the law are clearly on our side, and we will ultimately prevail. Why is TikTok getting banned in the U.S.? New TikTok law comes on the heels of years of national debate surrounding potential national security risks posed by the platform. In November 2022, FBI Director Christopher Wray told Congress that he was extremely concerned the Chinese government would weaponize the data collected through TikTok. Lawmakers say control of the app by a foreign adversary poses the potential for Beijing to use it to collect intelligence on U.S. users and to spread Chinese government propaganda on sensitive topics such as the Israel-Hamas war. Many Americans, particularly young Americans, are rightfully skeptical. At the end of the day, they've not seen what Congress has seen. They've not been in the classified briefings that Congress has held, which have delved more deeply into some of the threats posed by foreign control of TikTok. Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said on the Senate floor Tuesday. TikTok says it's never been asked to provide U.S. user data to the Chinese government and wouldn't if asked. When will TikTok be deleted? The new law grants ByteDance up to a year to sell TikTok. And if the parent company does not divest from the app by then, a nationwide ban would go into effect. So it would take at least a year for the app to be banned. Should the law be challenged in court, the process could be prolonged months, even years. If and when a ban goes into effect, TikTok will not suddenly disappear from users' phones. How would a TikTok ban work? A ban would mean TikTok will be removed from Apple and Google's app stores, which means those who didn't previously have the app won't be able to download it. It would still be available on the phones of users who already had it, but TikTok would not be able to update the app or send bug fixes or security patches. Over time, the app would become unusable. Are there workarounds to the TikTok ban? Banning the app won't necessarily stop TikTok fans in the U.S. from using it. Various strategies for staying on TikTok are available to tech-savvy users, including using a VPN, which is a virtual private network, or changing the phone location to fool the app stores. Another option is sideloading, downloading and installing a bootleg version of the TikTok app from the internet, but doing so carries the risk of downloading malware. Users could even install a foreign SIM card into their phones to try to maintain the app. In one more story on the business page, stocks improve as investors focus on next moves by Fed. Chibuki Oga of Reuters writes this article, Dateline New York. U.S. stocks ended higher on Monday with sharp gains for Tesla and Apple leading the way as investors looked toward what the Federal Reserve would say about the interest rate outlook after its policy meeting this week. Traders expected the Fed to keep rates unchanged while striking a hawkish tone. Tesla shares surged 15.3% after the electric vehicle maker made progress in securing regulatory approval to launch its advanced driver assistance program in China, its second largest market after the U.S. Apple gained 2.5% following a report that the iPhone maker had renewed discussions with OpenAI about using the startup's generative artificial intelligence technology. Bernstein upgraded Apple stock to outperform. Other mega-cap stocks finished lower, including Alphabet, Meta Platforms, and Microsoft. NVIDIA closed higher after paring early losses. 9 out of 11 S&P 500 sectors ended higher, led by stocks in consumer discretionary, utilities, real estates, materials, and industrials. Equities in communication services and financials were the biggest losers. The bigger question that rates, because they're not going to cut this week, is how hawkish they're going to speak, because they already have been pretty hawkish, said Thomas Hayes, chairman at hedge fund Great Hill Capital in New York. Money markets are pricing in about 35 basis points of interest rate cuts this year, down from about 150 BPSs seen at the beginning of the year, according to LSEG. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 146.43 points, or 0.38%, to 38,386.09. The S&P 500 gained 16.21 points, or 0.32%, to 5,116.17, and the NASDAQ composite gained 55.18 points, or 0.35%, to 15,983.08. Shares of Domino Pizza jumped 5.6% after topping expectations for first quarter same-store sales. Of the 233 companies in the S&P 500 that have reported quarterly earnings, 78.1% surpassed analyst expectations, compared with a long-term average of 67%, according to LSEG data.
Does it surprise anyone that there's record profits in consumable goods?
No.
Go to the store. I mean, my God, everything costs twice as much.
They're almost changing the prices in front of you when you're in there.
Yeah, oh my God. Eggs, $2.49 a dozen.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay, so moving on to the opinion page. This is submitted by Andy Furman, who is a guest columnist and a pretty well-known guy around town. It's entitled, "It's Time for Cincinnati to Try to Land NFL Draft." The NFL draft is over, but in reality, it could be the beginning for Cincinnati. No, I'm not talking about any of the players the Bengals picked over seven rounds. If the three-day party in Detroit taught us anything, it should be this. Why not us? Why can't Cincinnati host the NFL draft? Only 13 cities have hosted the NFL draft since it was established in 1936. These cities include, and they list the years, but I'm not going to read them all. These cities include Chicago, quite a few years, Cleveland 1 year, Dallas 1 year, Kansas City 1 year, Las Vegas 1 year, Los Angeles 1 year, Milwaukee 1 year, New York City a bunch of years, Nashville, Tennessee 1 year, Paradise, Nevada 1 year, Philadelphia a bunch of years, Pittsburgh 2 years, and Washington, D.C., the very first draft was held in 1936 at the Ritz-Carlton in Philadelphia. Following a virtual draft in 2020, it returned to an in-person format with Cleveland, then Paradise, Nevada, followed by Kansas City last year, and Detroit being this year's host city. In fact, Detroit was chosen as the host city over Washington, D.C., and the Green Bay. Green Bay gets the nod next year. But where is Cincinnati, and why not us? Cincinnati is a city that prides itself on major events, but nothing like the NFL draft. Sure, Blink is a biggie, but quite honestly, it's a bit off-Broadway. It returns here October 17 to 20 and promotes itself as the world's biggest art and light show. Every 2 years in mid-October, Blink turns Greater Cincinnati into a live-action art installation that is family-friendly, free, and open to the public, according to its website. Perhaps, but I've yet to see it on national TV. Good Morning America, the national ABC shows that tours the country, has yet to make a stop in Cincinnati. The city can also boast of Oktoberfest, the second largest one in the world, next to Germany. Again, ESPN will show the July 4th hot dog eating contest from Brooklyn's Coney Island. We haven't seen Cincinnati on the four-letter network with Oktoberfest. And as for crowds, the Oktoberfest promoters claim 500,000 people gobble up the goodies. But those folks are basically from the tri-state. How many hotel reservations are made? Let's get back to the NFL draft. The TV announcers claim 400,000 fans packed the streets of Detroit this year, and there were representatives from all 32 NFL teams. You could see the jerseys they were wearing. As for the economy, hotels and restaurants must have loved the three-day extravaganza. We were told a college football game might appear in town. The Chili Bowl, thanks to Skyline Chili, would be a natural, but we are still waiting. The NFL draft has become one of the biggest and most anticipated sporting events in the year. The distribution includes the NFL Network, ABC, and ESPN, and its properties. I am not being critical of our great city, but all I ask is, why not us? Andy Furman's a member of the Inquirer Board of Contributors, spoke in a talk sports nationally on Fox Radio, serves as the PAR coordinator for the Point Arc in Northern Kentucky, and writes for the Brooklyn, New York Daily Eagle. Joe.
Letters to the editor. First letter today. I propose the Albee Arch be relocated to Eden Park behind the Art Museum Metro stop on Art Museum Drive near the Season Good Pavilion and serve as the top entrance to the steps that leads to the Elsinore Castle. These steps are a hidden gem, and the Albee Arch would dramatically encourage visitors to stop and explore the marble masterpiece and hopefully explore both ends of the steps with another arch to explore, creating a bookend of arches with steps in between. As there is no public parking near the Elsinore Castle, this would also encourage more people to explore the Elsinore Castle. For those familiar with these Eden Park steps, it's like exploring an enchanted forest with a high canopy of trees overhead, providing shade and filtered light with the vistas of the forest on all sides. If we really want to encourage the public to experience the Albee Arch, I can almost guarantee that wedding photographers will quickly embrace the Albee Arch as their go-to location for that must-have wedding picture. It will also soon become the place to propose to the special person and will become a favorite backdrop for a family photos. Sadly, none of that was really possible at the Albee Arch's current location, so in a way, this third time may be the charm as a permanent location of the Albee Arch. Brian Frank of Mount Adams wrote that. What will happen to Marine Corps Memorial at Lytle Park? Regarding fountain walking path to join Lincoln at Lytle Park, that was April the 26th, I read the article about the renovation of Lytle Park in Friday's paper. I really would like to know about what's going to be done. Will the Corporal Merrill Laws Ricketts Marine Corps Memorial Marker be moved to another location? I ask this since my granduncle, Dr. B.M. Ricketts, donated the monument to the city on July 4, 1921. My mother, at age of three, unveiled it. Dr. Ricketts donated the memorial to the city in honor of all Hamilton County Marines killed in World War I, including his son, who was killed in the final days of the war. The memorial has been relocated on several occasions. I hope it will remain in memory of all Marines killed in all wars for this country. I would also like to see an article about Dr. Ricketts, since he contributed a lot to the city. His medical contributions should not be forgotten. And Kathleen Fuller of Western Hills wrote that. And the last letter. Super Bowl ring must not have been that valuable to Jason Kelce. I've waited for a comment on Jason Kelce's lost Super Bowl ring fiasco, but since no one else has dared dip their toe into the Chili Bowl, here goes. I can respect his judgment on the playing field for both UC Bearcats and the Philadelphia Eagles, but when it comes to his participation in an inane activity known as Lom Baby Games, he was a bit foolhardy. Not only is the idea of wasting food appalling, but why would a rational thinking person purposely place a valuable item in a sock in a pool of chili? It also begs the question, how valuable was it to you, Jason? And Clint Ibelli, I don't know how he pronounces the last name, of Highland Heights, Kentucky, wrote that.
You got any background on that story? I don't know what happened.
They had this thing up at UC. These two guys, Kelce brothers, were in town to do a podcast.
Right.
And they had some kind of a contest. There were two rings. There was a fake one and a real one.
Okay.
And you put the I think maybe both of them were in socks. I don't know. But nevertheless, the real ring, which was, I read this article last week, was supposed to be a $100,000 value. $100,000.
Put it in a bowl of chili?
They put it in a sock and then they put it in this big, that. Like, no, it was like a swimming pool of chili.
Oh, my.
I mean, you know, a kid's wading pool of chili.
Wow.
I suspect somebody pulled it out.
Well, I would imagine.
Yeah. Somebody they could got never it. Find the thing when it was over.
I'll shift gears a little bit from the normal Wednesday tradition and start with the front of the Inquirer with Today in History and followed by the local buzz. And Joe will go on to read the top news of the day. Today in History, today is May 1st, 2024. On this date, in 1486, Christopher Columbus presented his plan to Spain's Queen Isabella for a sea voyage to seek a western route to Asia. Took him a while to get that done, because I think he set out in 1492, if I remember my history, or the little poem. In 1866, the Memphis Massacre of 1866 began as a white mob, including police officers, attacked black residents, killing 46 and robbing others, and destroying many buildings, including homes, churches, and schools. In 1893, World's Columbian Exposition, also called the Chicago World's Fair, opened. Inventions, devices, and foods that were introduced or touted at the fair, including a moving walkway, the Ferris wheel, an electric vehicle, juicy fruit gum, and peanut butter. In 1898, in the first major battle of the Spanish-American War, the U.S. destroyed the Spanish Pacific Fleet in Manila Bay in the Philippines. 1926, the Ford Motor Company adopted a 5-day, 40-hour work week for its factory workers, becoming one of the first U.S. companies to do so. The policy was later expanded for office workers. In 1931, New York City's Empire State Building was dedicated. It had risen in just over a year to become the tallest building in the world at the time, with a height of 1,250 feet, 1454 when including the lightning rod at the top. Interesting story about that. The DuPonts and the Chryslers were trying to build the biggest building in the world, and Chrysler got his finish, and then the Empire State Building went up shortly thereafter. In 1960, an American spy plane was shot down over the Soviet Union. Pilot Francis Powers was captured and held prisoner until he was exchanged in 62 for a Soviet spy in U.S. custody. And in 1971, Amtrak began operating the first federally run passenger rail service across the United States. Moving to the local buzz briefly, a famous Cincinnati ice cream chain has launched a new mysterious spring offering. Grater's Ice Cream released its latest creation, the Mystery Tasting Pack, on Monday. It's available exclusively online for $84.95 while supplies last. According to the press release, the limited edition pack allows ice cream lovers to engage in a blind tasting experience with 6 never-before-seen flavors made in small 2.5-gallon batches in the brand's classic French pots. In addition to the 6 unique pints of ice cream, each pack also comes with pint number tags, scorecards, and instructions for conducting a blind tasting. The pints have been carefully wrapped to keep the flavors a secret, but the names of the mystery flavors can be found on the inside of the lid. We're expected to offer our fans a chance to experience the thrill of discovering new flavors while adding an element of surprise, owner Bob Grater said in this release. The 6-pack is sure to delight our loyal fans and show ice cream lovers across the U.S. what Grater's Ice Cream is all about. Grater's Ice Cream has produced French pot ice cream in the region since 1870. It has currently 56 retail stores and ships over 300,000 pints annually. Grater's can also be found in over 3,000 grocery stores in the United and 46 states, most of which probably say Kroger on the front. So that's interesting. $84 is great value for 6 pints of ice cream, don't you think, Joe?
Quite a bit, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Is that it for that?
That's it for me.
All righty. Moving to the front page of today's Inquirer, Terry DeMaio, Inquirer staffer, writes this story. Dr. Uma Cottigal, now 76, was a Cincinnati Children's neonatologist. caring for newborns in the 1970s when she first encountered a whole different kind of baby, the gorilla. Cottigal was not only among the first Cincinnati Children's pediatricians to work with Cincinnati Zoo animals, she worked with the first gorillas born there. She would bring her daughters, Mira and Kalpana, to the zoo with her when she could, so they could watch her and other caregivers treat the baby gorillas. The girls later joined a junior zoologist program there. When she grew up, Mira Cottigal followed a similar professional path as her mother. She is a Cincinnati Children's surgeon and director of the hospital's trauma services. Also following her mother's love of the animals, she became chair of the Cincinnati Zoo Ambassador Council. Also like her mother, who is now a professor emerita at Cincinnati Children's Pediatric Department, Dr. Mira Cottigal joined the support staff from the hospital that is called upon to care for zoo animals, including gorillas. The mother and daughter both have cared for Gladys, the 11-year-old gorilla, who was fitted with a titanium cast last week after undergoing surgery for a broken arm. Mira Cottigal assisted with Gladys's arm repair surgery. The doctors talked with the Enquirer about their experiences with the gorillas this week. We edited their responses for clarity and length. We've used their first names to be clear since they share the same last name. Question. Uma, how did you become involved with the zoo animals and particularly gorillas? As a neonatologist at Cincinnati Children's, my work with human newborns was similar to the needs that the zoo had with its new baby gorillas. Another doctor and I were called in to help the zoo team identify causes of the gorillas' infections. Soon, we were also treating some of the littlest gorillas, who seemed to be a lot like human children. The team developed a treatment protocol that became a standard for the zoos across the country. Question, Mira, can you share a memory of being at the zoo with your sister as your mother worked with the gorillas? Mira, in a lot of ways, my sister and I sort of grew up at the zoo, and when we were little, my mom started helping with the newborn gorillas. We saw baby gorillas in the nursery, but we also watched gorillas in their habitat. We used to just sit and watch them. That was sort of our favorite destination. Question. Things have changed since your mom worked so closely with baby gorillas in the 1980s compared to now with the work you do. Tell us about that. Back when my mom first started helping and the gorillas would be getting sick, a lot of times they had diarrheal illnesses, which are pretty common in kids too. The doctors would often take the baby gorillas in order to help rehydrate them or other things that they needed from a treatment standpoint. And I think at that time we didn't necessarily realize that their moms were great at taking care of them and knew how to do that. Now humans keep their distance as much as possible. Question. Uma, when you and Mira met Gladys as a baby, did she seem to have her own, or as we humans could call it, personality? Uma, yes, Gladys came to us young, but bright and sassy. Even then, as a baby, she was sprite and charming. She got along with the older primates, seeming comfortable and connected. Question. Mira, what can you tell us about the encounter with Gladys? We understand you and your mother diagnosed her with an umbilical hernia, and two other doctors fixed it. We were being really careful to try to limit her contact with humans because the goal was obviously for her to be a gorilla and not to be a human baby. I did hold her when I was examining her in order to kind of make a diagnosis. As you know, they're a lot like babies, but bigger and furrier, and you get a sense of the wildness. What was it like for you seeing Gladys again at 11 years old, Mira? She has a much more developed musculature of her upper extremities because she moves that way and hangs and navigates through spaces in ways that we don't as humans. She's 150 pounds. I can't carry her anymore. Are you seeing Gladys regularly? Mira, I'm mostly treating myself by going to see her, but, you know, we all worry about our patients no matter whether they're human or gorilla. And we have every reason to be optimistic that she'll have a really good outcome from the repair. Can you share how the rest of us can best experience the Cincinnati Zoo gorillas? Uma, spend time observing an individual gorilla, the silverback or the baby and the mom or a juvenile. baby and mom, or as you know. Watch how they play and interact, especially the young ones. They play and startle each other as a game. Watch the interactions between the different troop members and see how they treat each other. Each relationship is different. Mira, I think the biggest thing is just being present. When we were kids, we used to just go and stand, you know, and watch them and watch their interactions and just be present without expectation that they're going to do something. I think when you come to see creatures like Gladys or like any of the other sort of magical moments that we have, just being patient and taking the time to just sit in the moment to be in, and to be present and experience it, because sometimes it takes time. There's a lot of really amazing things to see when you give space to them.
Well, that was an interesting story, Joe. It's also interesting to me that we've got 56 campuses with protests about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict going on, some of them very active, and our hometown lead paper is about baby gorillas.
Yeah, there you go.
There you go. Welcome to Cincinnati. Mandates are added to parental rights bill. Opponents changed by Ohio senators. Changes by Ohio senators say that's too harsh. This is submitted by Eric Glenn, the State Bureau. Ohio senators' changes to House Bill 8, referred to as Parents' Bill of Rights, bring the potential law more in line with Florida's controversial law, nicknamed Don't Say Gay, by opponents. Opponents say the bill will force outing of students to their parents and targets of LGBTQ students or students with LGBTQ families. Supporters say it's about giving parents authority over their children. House Bill 8 originally would have required schools to notify parents about any sexually explicit learning materials, defined as any description or pictures depicting sexual conduct. Parents' Bill of Rights increasingly more stringent. The original bill would also require schools to notify parents about any provided health care services. It would have banned school staff from encouraging a student to withhold information about their health or well-being from their parents unless disclosure would result in abuse, abandonment, or neglect. Republicans on the House Primary and Secondary Education Committee removed the exception for suspected abuse and neglect. They also changed the bill's language from sexually explicit content to sexual content, which is defined as any description or depiction of sexual concepts or gender ideology. The bill does not define gender ideology. There are exceptions for education about preventing venereal disease, child sexual abuse, and sexual violence. They also added language explicitly requiring parents to be told if a student requests to, quote, identify as a gender that does not align with the student's biological sex, unquote. The bill passed Ohio House 6529 in June. Does Ohio already require parental notification? Under the current law, schools are required to notify parents of any instruction that goes beyond the criteria for venereal disease education. Parents can review any sexual education materials in their students' school upon request, and school districts must have parental review of circulation. School districts are also required to excuse students from sexual education and assault prevention if a parent requests it. A contentious hearing. On April 23rd, the Senate Education Committee approved changes to the bill that would ban any curriculum with sexual content in kindergarten through third grade and require a parent's consent for any physical or mental health care the school provides, which are the same two parts of the Florida law. Harley Rubin, a transgender person and graduate student at Case Western Reserve University, submitted written testimony about coming out in high school and seeking help from the school counselor regularly after his father's yelling. Rubin told the USA Today Ohio Network Bureau he believes the bill will endanger students. Not only will it not educate kids fully and restrict what can be said in schools, but it would also risk student safety, violate their privacy, and create a barrier between them and school professionals, he said. Committee Chair Senator Andrew Brenner, Republican of Delaware, disagreed with this characterization during the hearing. Six people testified about the bill during the hearing. Five speakers were against the bill, and one was in favor. Concerns about forced outing of students. Liam Strasbaugh with the National Association of Social Workers in Ohio expressed concerns with the conflict the bill may present with the Social Workers Code of Conduct, emphasizing the need for confidentiality and respect for client autonomy. Mandating that the school staff report a child's innermost thoughts and feelings to parents immediately can be incredibly damaging to a child's therapeutic process and would discourage youth from sharing anything at all with the support staff, he said. Brenner asked what part of the bill would facilitate the forced outing of students and asked if a student would already be out if they were going by another name. Rubin told the USA Today Network Ohio Bureau, coming out to a counselor or a teacher can be the one path to coming out to one's, can be on the path to coming out to one's parents. You're trying to figure out, I know this is a person accept people like me, so I'm just going to give it a shot. Then they can help me try to decide how I'm going to tell my parents. It's not about keeping anything from your parents, but getting to it and trying to do that in a safe way. Troy McIntosh with the Center for Christian Virtue spoke in favor of the bill. Government actors cannot and must not be allowed to supersede the authority of the parents on these particular topics. That's all this bill does. It is not a don't say gay bill, as much as people want to think link that to the language. It's not, he said at the hearing. Again, that was submitted by Eric Glenn, who's a reporter for USA Today. Joe?
All right. Quinlan Bentley, Enquirer staffer, writes this story. Gurpreet Singh's second murder trial began Monday in Butler County Common Pleas Court, 5 years and one day after his family was gunned down inside a Westchester Township apartment. A mistrial was declared at Singh's last trial in late 2022 after the jury couldn't reach a unanimous verdict. A three-judge panel is hearing the case this time and will decide on an outcome. Singh, 41, is charged with four counts of aggravated murder and faces the possibility of the death penalty if found guilty. Four people were killed at the lakefront apartment complex where Singh lived on April 28, 2019. Shailinderjit Kaur, 39, Singh's wife, Parmjit Kaur, 62, Singh's mother-in-law, Amarjit Kaur, 58, Singh's wife's aunt, and Hakekat Singh Panag, 59, Singh's father-in-law. It was a little mouthful. Each of the victims suffered numerous gunshot wounds to the head. They were all dead by the time Westchester police reached the apartment, according to trial testimony. Prosecutors say Singh was the only one who emerged from the apartment alive that night, and he's the only one with the motive and opportunity to kill his wife's family. It was Singh who reported the shooting to police in a frantic 911 call in which he claimed he'd just arrived at the apartment and found his family hurt. However, Singh lied to the police about not being home during the shooting. As evidence showed, he entered the apartment almost an hour before officers arrived, according to prosecutors. His attorneys do not dispute that fact, but say he witnessed his family's execution and cradled his wife's head while phoning 911 for help. Five people entered that apartment. Only one survived, Assistant Butler County Prosecutor John Marshall said during the opening statements. Singh put careful consideration into planning the killings, prosecutors said, adding he called in sick from his truck driving job and arranged for his children to be out of the apartment. Prosecutors say Singh's motive for shooting his family stemmed from an ongoing affair and his repeated demands for money from his father-in-law, with whom they said Singh had a strained relationship. In court filings, prosecutors said Singh gifted $20,000 to his mistress in Indianapolis so he could buy a house, bought her a car, and even purchased a home on the same street she lived on, indicating his plan for a long-term relationship. Singh and his mistress repeatedly called and messaged each other in the hours before and after the killings, prosecutors said, adding Singh tried to delete evidence of those communications. Prosecutor said Singh gunned down his father-in-law, who was asleep in bed, and executed his wife while standing over her. Singh had gunshot residue on his hands, and his clothes were covered in his family's blood, prosecutor said. A handgun with a serial number pried off was recovered from a pond near Singh's apartment. After a months-long investigation, Westchester police found that all signs pointed to Singh as the killer, according to Marshall, who noted that none of the victims had defensive wounds. That's because the person who killed them was someone they trusted, Marshall said. That's because the person who killed them is someone whose presence in that apartment did not give them alarm or concern. Singh's attorneys alluded to evidence of other possible suspects, saying prosecutors have failed to explain how killing his wife and her family would solve any of the alleged problems stemming from his affair. Alex Deardorff, one of Singh's attorneys, said Panag got into a legal dispute with two foreign nationals, both of whom have criminal histories, over the sale of 10 acres of land he owned in India. Those men were at imminent risk of losing roughly $1.2 million worth of investments due to that dispute, and they had been threatening the family and their representative, Deardorff said. Deardorff said the gunpowder residue found on Singh is only evidence that he was in the room, not that he pulled the trigger, and there's no DNA tying him to the recovered weapon. She also pointed to the apartment door being ripped from its hinges as clear evidence someone forced their way inside. He could not have been the shooter, and the background proves that someone else orchestrated this crime, Dierdorf said. The trial resumed with testimony Tuesday morning. It's expected to run through this week and into next week.
I remember reading that story 5 years ago when it happened. It was incredible.
Yep.
Speaking of incredible, new details revealed about the Claremont dad accused of killing his three sons, submitted by Cameron Knight from the Inquirer. Chad Dorman paced his house carrying a Bible and mumbling, "Chad knows what's right," before killing his three sons, according to documents filed by prosecutors. Dorman is charged with murder, accused of killing his sons Clayton, 7, Hunter, 4, and 3-year-old Chase at their home in Claremont County last June. Prosecutors are seeking the death penalty. Chief Assistant Prosecutor Lara Bacon Allen filed an amended bill of particulars in the Dorman case last week, revealing more details about what preceded the killings. The document states Dorman returned from work early that June 15th when he picked up a Bible and started walking around the house with it. He was mumbling, "Chad knows what's right," the document says. He then began to get into the gun safe, which was located in the master bedroom. His wife noticed his behavior and told Dorman he was scaring her. Dorman told her he was just kidding and playing around and decided to lie down. His wife didn't want him to be alone, so she and her sons went to the bedroom with him. At some point, Dorman got back out of the bed, got his .22 caliber Marvin rifle out of the gun safe, shot one of his sons twice, the document states. His wife immediately called 911, screaming for her other children to run. Dorman chased one of the boys into a field behind the house and shot him as he fled, then again at close range after the boy fell, according to the document. The boy's sister picked up her last surviving brother and then ran with him toward a nearby firehouse, but Dorman caught up to her at gunpoint and demanded she put the boy down. Once she put the child down, she begged the defendant not to shoot her. The document says she witnesses the defendant attempt to shoot the boy. However, the gun misfired, and he fled to his mother. The boy's sister kept running toward the fire station, telling a passerby that her father was killing everyone. Dorman went to the last boy and shot him. His mother suffered a gunshot wound to her hand trying to protect the boy, prosecutors said. The document said after the boys were dead, Dorman picked them up and laid their bodies next to each other in the yard. Law enforcement found Dorman sitting on his porch with a rifle at his side. The document says Dorman said, "I did it. Take me to jail." Statements Dorman made during an hours-long interview with law enforcement after the shootings will not be presented to a jury. Dorman's lawyer successfully argued that he had asked for an attorney, and the officers kept questioning him, a violation of his Miranda rights. Dorman has pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity, and evaluations of his mental state have been ordered. A final hearing on the case is scheduled for June 14th, one day before the anniversary of the killings. His trial is scheduled for July 8th.
Jeez.
I can't imagine.
Well, it's, I guess, the day for murders. This is the third straight murder story. Kevin Grasha, Inquirer staffer, writes this one. Mikeem Thomas, believed to be the only juvenile in Hamilton County history to face murder charges in 4 separate killings, smiled at times and even laughed during his plea and sentencing Monday. When the cousin of the 19-year-old Terrence North, who Thomas fatally shot in 2021, called out Thomas for smirking and concluded her statement by saying, "expletive you," the teen laughed to himself. Thomas, 17, was sentenced Monday in Common Pleas Court to 31 to 36 and a half years in prison, a term that had been agreed upon as part of his plea deal with prosecutors. Judge Robert Goring imposed the sentence. Thomas, who was prosecuted as an adult, pleaded guilty to 4 counts of manslaughter, 3 counts of felonious assault, 2 counts of robbery, as well as gun charges. Thomas was 14 when he was involved in the 4 killings, which happened between October 2020 and February 2021. He likely will be in his 40s when he's released from prison, a fact that prosecutors, police detectives, and the victims' families are not happy about. 31 years is not a number we like, Assistant Prosecutor Linda Scott said. But Scott said the convictions and sentence will give the families closure and ensure that none of the families ever hear a not guilty verdict, which Scott said can happen when someone so young stands trial. four killings in 4 months. The first killing happened on October 25th, 2020, during a robbery. Scott said the person killed, 19-year-old Devon Lipscomb, was Thomas's accomplice in the robbery, which Thomas helped set up. The target of the robbery shot Lipscomb after he walked up to the target's car and pointed a gun at a woman in the passenger seat. Thomas and another man, Robert Alley, were charged with murder in Lipscomb's death. Alley, 23, pleaded guilty in January to manslaughter and was sentenced to 10 years. North was killed on February 1st, 2021. Thomas used Facebook to lure North and another man to a location in South Fairmont, Scott said, under the guise of buying drugs that night from the man. Scott said Thomas fired multiple shots into a vehicle, killing North. The other man was shot in the face but survived. Thomas kept a photo of North's funeral service information on his cell phone, prosecutors said, because they believe he was auditioning for more. Prosecutor, 14-year-old hired for killing. Thomas was one of three people who Carl Godfrey hired to kill a man to whom Godfrey owed money. On February 16, 2021, Thomas and two others, according to testimony at Godfrey's trial earlier this year, fired 21 shots into an SUV outside a Westwood apartment complex, wounding the intended target and killing 27-year-old DeAndre Otis. He didn't stop there, Scott said Monday. 2 days later, she said Thomas went with Godfrey to Millvale because they wanted revenge. Godfrey's car had been shot up the previous day. Scott said both Thomas and Godfrey opened fire in the street, killing an innocent bystander, 30-year-old Donnell Steele. Scott and said Steele had walked outside to see what was happening and was shot in the eye. North's grandmother, Angela Smith, said it's time to put down the guns. There has to be something done, Smith said. These children are out there shooting one another. Unbelievable.
I must live in an insular world.
Unbelievable.
So while we're on guns, Blue Ash Chief guns are sought in a rash of car break-ins. So the Blue Ash Police, oh, this is by Amber Jayanth from Fox 19. The Blue Ash Police Chief is alerting residents to a rise in vehicle break-ins. Chief Scott Noel said during a press conference Monday that officers have responded to 84 break-ins in the past 30 days. This past month, several Fox Run or Deer Cross Parkway apartment complex residents have woken up to shattered windows and missing items from their vehicles. First couple of weeks, it was our hotels up north, like every hotel was getting hit, Noel said. Now it's apartment complexes. Chief said the past week alone, the apartment received a dozen more reported vehicle break-ins. He says the thieves are smashing through windows and rummaging through all the cars, stealing whatever they can, including several weapons. The chief says 25 to 30 guns were missing in the thefts. Who keeps their gun in their car? I don't know. Before it was used to be the old saying, don't leave anything in plain sight. It doesn't matter now, the chief said. All of the vehicles broken into over the weekend were locked. The windows were punched out, and then the thieves entered them. If there's nothing of value, they move on. The chief said the thieves were finding items hidden in the vehicles, and he urged gun owners not to leave their firearms in their cars. Noel said they have some surveillance video of one of the recent incidents. He said that it appears to be a group of four or five men or teens working together in two vehicles. Chief couldn't say if the group is responsible for all the break-ins. He said, if you do encounter them, do not approach and do call 911 as they are thought to be armed and dangerous. Brother. Blue Ash.
Unbelievable.
Give me a break.
Here's a better story, I hope. Victoria Morwood of the Enquirer staff writes this story. An event celebrating the 250th anniversary of the United States is planned for next year in Cincinnati. America's River Roots, a musical and cultural celebration, will take place in Cincinnati on the Ohio River in October 2025. The event is one of several festivities expected across the nation leading up to America's official quarter millennial on July 4th, 2026. Organizers will announce more details about America's River Roots at 9 a.m. Wednesday at the National Underground Railroad Freedom Center. Ohio Governor Mike DeWine will be appearing virtually. Mayor Aftab Perval, Hamilton County Commissioner Alicia Reese, and others will be making remarks. When is America's River Roots? The event will be held October 9th through the 12th, 2025, according to a press release. And what is it? America's River Roots will bring a lineup of music, food, and cultural attractions to Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky's riverfront areas to celebrate the United States' 250th anniversary in 2026. The event is expected to draw hundreds of thousands of people and millions of dollars.
Well, well, I hope there's going to be big tall ships there, those steamboats. I love that. Yeah. Well, another light note, there's a Marty Brenneman Field dedication called This One Belongs to the Fans. Marty Brenneman Field at, I think it's called Julius Park in Anderson Township, has a new infield. A dedication ceremony for the all-weather synthetic turf infield was held Saturday at the park at 8249 Clough Pike, and Brenneman attended the ceremony. The field was named in honor of the Cincinnati Reds Radio Hall of Fame broadcaster in 2008. Brenneman, who lived in Anderson Township for many years, was the play-by-play voice of the Reds from 1974 until his retirement in 2019. Work to upgrade the dirt infield began in March. It was funded by the American Parks Capital Levy, passed in November, and contributions from Cincinnati Reds Community Fund, Anderson Township Youth Sports, the Kid Glove Program, and the Julius Foundation, according to organizers.
I think we're done with the regular paper.
You got a couple more business articles if you want to read those.
Yeah, that's what I was going to go to now. This one's entitled Renting Better Than Buying in Big Cities. Mendora Lee of the USA Today writes this article. If you're a big city dweller, it's better to rent than buy a home pretty much anywhere, according to financial products comparison site Bankrate. The monthly cost of buying across all 50 of the largest metro statistical areas is 37% higher than renting a typical home, Bankrate said. As of February, the typical monthly mortgage payment of a median-priced U.S. home was $2,703, while the typical monthly rent nationally was $1,979. With such a large gap between what it takes to buy versus renting a home, Americans who are already financially stretched should feel confident they're making the right choice to rent, said Bankrate analyst Alex Gailey. For those weighing whether they should rent or buy right now, all signs point to renting as the most cost-effective option in most major U.S. cities, said Gailey. Where are the biggest gaps between renting and buying? In 21 of the 50 largest U.S. metros, the typical monthly cost of owning is at least 50% more expensive than the typical monthly cost of renting. Four of the five top metros with the largest gap are in the West, where the cost of living tends to be higher, Bankrate said. In San Francisco, Oakley, Berkeley, California, the average monthly rent is $3,024, while the typical mortgage payment is $8,486.
What?
Yeah, 180% spread.
Huh.
That can't be right. Who can pay $8,486 a month for owning a mortgage?
Yeah, that's big.
Yeah. San Jose, Sunnyvale, Santa Clara, California. Monthly rent, $3,255 on average versus a mortgage payment of 8,562% gap.
Wow.
Seattle, Tacoma, Bellevue, Washington. The average monthly rent is $2,191 and mortgage payments are $4,930. In Salt Lake City, Utah, monthly rent $1,673, and a typical mortgage payment $3,161, 89% gap. Austin, Round Rock, Georgetown, Texas, typical monthly rent $1,753 compared to an average of $3,269 mortgage payment, another 86% gap. Where are the smallest gaps between renting and buying? The Northeast and Midwest, where the cost of living tends to be lower, had the smallest gaps, but it was cheaper to rent than buy, Bankrate said. In Detroit, Warren, Dearborn, Michigan, typically monthly rent is $1,395, and the average mortgage payment is $1,423. That's only a 2% gap. Pittsburgh, monthly rent is $1,415 on average compared to typical mortgage payment of $1,488, 5% gap. Philadelphia, Camden, Wilmington, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, Maryland, couple of states there. A month of rent is $1,829, but a typical mortgage payment is $1,988, only 8.7% difference. Cleveland, Elyria, Ohio, monthly rent $1,377, and the mortgage payment's $1,537, 11% gap. In Buffalo, Chautauqua, I can never pronounce that one.
Chautauqua,
New York. Average monthly rent is $1,295, and the typical mortgage payment is $1,556 and a 20% gap.
There's three of those cities I want to move to, and two I couldn't touch with a stick.
Oh.
Yeah.
You couldn't get me out to San Francisco or any place like that anymore.
Well, forget about the $8,600 rent. I just don't want to go there.
That's what I'm saying. I wouldn't go there anyway.
Yeah. That used to be one of my favorite cities.
That was my favorite. I used to think 20, 30 years ago, that was the best city to visit as a tourist.
Yep. I agree with you. Yep. So, interesting article here. Williams-Sonoma fined $3.2 million for false claims. Products from China labeled made in the USA. Williams-Sonoma is facing a... Oh, by the way, this is written by Eric Legata. Williams-Sonoma is facing a costly penalty for falsely claiming that some of its products were made in the USA, the Federal Trade Commission announced. Under the terms of a settlement, the San Francisco-based home furnishing retailer agreed to pay a $3.17 million fine for violating a 2020 order that required its company to be truthful about where its products were made. The order stemmed from a previous lawsuit against Williams-Sonoma that also ended with the company agreeing to pay a $1 million fine. But the FTC's latest lawsuit against Williams-Sonoma, the federal agency stated that the company has continued to make deceptive claims about the origin of its products, many of which were in fact found to be made in China. The newest civil penalty is the largest ever in a made-in-USA case, the federal agency, which forces consumer protection laws, said Friday. The FTC first sued Williams-Sonoma in 2020 after investigating reports of multiple products that the company had falsely listed on its website and catalog as being made in the United States. Among those products were the company's Gold Touch bakeware, some of its rejuvenation home improvement products, and certain pieces of upholstered furniture sold under the Pottery Barn Teen and Pottery Barn Kids brands, the FTC said. The company is required to pay $1 million to the FTC and agreed to an order that required it to stop its deceptive claims and follow the agency's Made in USA requirements. But earlier this year, a consumer alerted truthinadvertising.org about a mattress pad falsely advertised on Pottery Barn Teen's website as crafted in America from domestic and imported materials. The mattress pad that arrived was labeled Made in China, according to the Truth in Advertising, an independent watchdog, which provided screenshots on its website. Truthinadvertising.org tipped off the FTC about the product page advertising the mattress pad. In addition to the civil penalty, the federal court settlement also requires Williams-Sonoma to submit annual compliance certifications. That story shocked me a little bit. I always thought Williams-Sonoma was kind of heads-up crew.
So did I. All quality stuff, I thought.
Yep.
Another business story here written by Siddharth Kavail of Reuters. Walmart said on Tuesday it will close all 51 of its health centers and shut its virtual healthcare operations, saying it could not see it as a sustainable business model to continue. Healthcare is expensive to run. We're finding that the increased labor and operating costs environment, like with reimbursement, both public and private, made it difficult to run the business, and obviously we had to close. Walmart spokeswoman Mary Lee McGinnis told Reuters. The company said in a statement, those challenges created an environment where it saw a lack of profitability that made the care business unsustainable for us at the time. The world's largest retailer expects to close the 51 health centers, which are typically located next to Walmart supercenters and house doctors and dentists, within 30 to 90 days, McGinnis said. The clinics will spread across 5 states, including Texas and Florida. The Bentonville, Arkansas-based company launched the health business in Georgia in 2019, offering primary care, dental care, behavioral health, labs and x-ray, audiology, and telehealth services. Walmart declined to disclose the sales it made from each health center or the losses Walmart might incur from closing the business. While this decision is disappointing to management, we believe it's immaterial to their Financial Outlook, D.A. Davidson analyst Michael Baker said. The company said it would instead focus on its nearly 4,600 pharmacies and more than 3,000 vision centers located within its stores that offer many of the services that its healthcare centers offered. Walmart pharmacies, for instance, offer clinical services like testing and treatment for respiratory illnesses like flu and strep, which were also offered at health centers. Companies such as Walmart, Walgreens, Amazon, and CVS have expanded into providing healthcare services during the past 5 years, seeing opportunities in the highly fragmented U.S. system. But it's not been clear that the consumers want such services from retailers or that they are profitable. The struggles show how difficult it is to crack the U.S. healthcare system, which is a conglomeration of employer-funded care, private health insurance, and government programs that cost the United States $4.5 trillion in 2022. More recently, the sector's been facing other issues, including a shortage of physicians and rising costs of drugs. I think we got 2 minutes left.
Well, I can't read the whole article on, but Michigan is exploring AI in a variety of ways, like traffic lights that turn red or green in response to traffic flows. Governor Whitmer's put a lot of money in the budget for that sort of stuff. That's about all I got to say on that. How's your day going, Joe?
I can't complain.
And if the Inquirer is a couple of minutes short, well, I don't think anybody's going to lose too much sleep about it.
I think you're correct.
Yeah.
Have a good day, folks.